You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series. Truth, Objectivity, and Self-Interest with Harry Binswanger and Dave Rubin.
All right. I'm glad to be sitting down with you. And we're doing this on the Ayn Rand channel, on the ARI channel.
Right.
You knew Ayn Rand. We've done a little bit before talking about this. But can you tell me a little bit about Ayn Rand?
Yeah, I can tell you how I first got interested in her and her ideas. I was a freshman in college, and she came to speak at my school, and my life was a mess. I was starting, my grades were going down. I was starting to fail courses. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't know whether there was any point to anything. And she was speaking on ethics, and I thought, well, maybe she has some answers. I went to her talk in front of a huge audience, and she had a thick Russian accent, and I couldn't follow it. I didn't see what it was all about. And then she came to one section where she said, man has a choice to focus his mind or to drift in the semi-conscious daze. And I thought, God, I'm drifting in the semi-conscious daze right now. This is the most important thing I've ever heard. And it's like obvious, but I don't think I've ever heard that before. And so I leaned forward and I tried to listen intently to the rest of the speech. I didn't get much, but the question period impressed me tremendously. Like two questions I remember. She was asked, are you an atheist? And she said, of course. And the way she said, of course, was with the tone of voice of, do you eat with silverware or not your fingers? Well, of course, you know, and I thought, I heard in my mind, of course. It like threw the question into a totally different realm, that it was an actual question. Do I think there's something up in the sky that is pure spirit looking? No, I don't think that. So that was important. The other one was she was asked, what is the objective of sexual ethics? Now, this was at the beginning of the sexual revolution, Hugh Hefner and everything. Mm-hmm. It was just starting. And she began by saying, we're very chaste. Chaste? Huh. What?
Huh.
What? I think this woman takes herself seriously, you know? And this was at the beginning of the Kennedy administration, to the end of the Eisenhower years, where everything was gray and there were no blacks and whites. She was very firm and absolute, and I liked that a lot. So I went on spring break and bought Atlas Shrugged. And after I was in a few pages, I thought, my God, this is it. This is it. Where's this been all my life, you know? And I took a year before I would decide that I was in agreement with it. I thought, I'm not going to say that I buy into this for a year. And I'm going to spend that year asking people, what's the hidden flaw? And I asked people, and they sounded like one of the characters in her book, you know? It's like she had those lines already, and she had the answers to them. So rather, what it said to me was, it's not the case that people know more than she did, and they're looking down and saying, oh, no, she messed up on it. It's that she knows what they think they know, and the answer to that, she knows more than they do. So after a year, I decided that's my philosophy. And I went into philosophy. I was going to be a physicist, but I got turned into philosophy, and it's just been an obsession ever since.
Well, then that's a perfect segue to truth.
Yeah.
As objective as it is. Truth is not subjective. It's objective, according to you.
It's objective, yes. It's objective that this glass is here. It's objective that if you lie to people, they won't trust you, and eventually you'll get caught. It's objective that American civilization is superior to the civilization of Yemen. That it's objective that if you stab a knife into your heart, you will bleed and die. I mean, these things cannot be wished away. So the first axiom of objectivism is existence exists. That's it. Things are what they are. A is A. This table is here. And going back to the same college story, same period, I had a fraternity brother named AJ who told me the story, and it sounds like a stand-up comic routine, but it actually happened. I checked with him years later, and he said, yes, that actually happened. So AJ was taking a humanities course, and before he got there a little late. He learned later that the professor had said, there's one thing I won't tolerate in this class, and that's smoking. Because this was 1961, and people smoked in class and just threw their butts on the floor, which was, you know, hard floor. It's an evil, disgusting habit. I won't have it in my class. If you smoke in my class, I'm throwing you out. So then AJ comes in, and he takes a seat. The professor says, now, and takes a piece of chalk from the chalk blackboard and says, what is this? Piece of chalk. How do you know it's a piece of chalk? Could be a white pencil. It could be a specially fake piece of chalk I had made up to fool you, and it's really made out of paper mache. You could be dreaming now. How do you know this is really a piece of chalk here? At that point, AJ lights up. And the professor says, what's that? And AJ takes a cigarette and says, I don't know. It could be a paper mache. It could be an illusion. I might be dreaming right now, thinking he had it. He had the point.
Yeah.
And that actually happened. But that's the answer that's proper to people who say that when they say there is no truth, they're claiming that is true. So when you say, no, truth is this way, not that way, doesn't matter what you're claiming that is true. You're claiming that I can see the mind's relationship to reality, and it's not the way you describe it, it's the way I describe it. There's no escape from the claim that something is true. There is one escape. Shut up. Aristotle said, right. You know, if you want to be a vegetable, you don't have to claim anything is true.
Why do you think that today it seems that so many people think truth is subjective?
Because there was a philosopher named Immanuel Kant 200 years ago who had a really tricky argument. He said, he didn't deny that there was truth outright. He said, we can't see things as they really are. And Peterson said this in one of the podcasts, not on yours, but when he was on Sam Harrison. We can't see things as they really are. We only see things as they appear to be to us with our senses. And we can't know what they really are with real objective reason. We only know what they are with human reason, right? So what we know is a world of appearances. We don't know the thing in itself. So truth has to be interpreted as this is the way things appear to me, or to the human race, actually, he thought. So he subjectivized truth without saying he was doing that. And those arguments have never been answered until Ayn Rand answered them, but her answer is not well known. So the distinction between appearance and reality that Kant made in the terms he made is really tricky and convinced a lot of people, and they pushed it.
So how does one know that they know the absolute truth then? Because couldn't anyone claim the truth, and then now we're in just a battle of what's true. We live in a time where actually a lot of people are doing this all the time now.
Yeah, the opposite of the subjective theory is the dogmatic revelation theory.
Right.
I got the truth from the Bible or right. God or whatever. But that's the same false, that's the other side of the same coin, the same false coin. The only way you can know it is prove it. Now, what's true? How do you prove it? Well, objectivism has a different concept of proof than has prevailed in the last couple of centuries. It says that proof is taking ideas back to sense perception. Because sense perception can't be wrong. You can't make a mistake in seeing the glass. You can make a mistake in interpreting what you see. But you see what you see by the physical causality of the light striking your retina. That's a registration of reality. There's no higher standard. So if you can reduce your ideas back to perceptual reality, which is, how to do that. But
so first principles, basically.
Yeah. But the first principles are sense perception. Like, existence exists. Well, how do you know existence exists? I said, that was our first principle, existence exists. There it is. You see it, you hear it, you feel it. That's how you know it. It's not by, oh, like Descartes, no, I deduce because I have the idea of an external world and God exists and he wouldn't deceive me, so there must really, no, you just see it. So proof is what we resort to when we can't directly perceive a fact. Proof is indirect, you know, building on perception and observation.
Is there a risk, though, in trusting our senses all the time? You can go to a great magic show, and they can make you think you saw something that you didn't see.
No, they can make you misinterpret what you saw and think the way to describe what you saw is X when it's really Y. So you say, I saw him put the hat on the table. No, you saw what a camera would photograph, right? Mm. That stream of perceptions is real. You interpreted that as he's putting the hat on the table, but he really put a different hat on the table mm-hmm. that you didn't see switched in, you know? So you saw what you saw that a camera would capture, you misinterpreted. And you can misinterpret the senses, but basically we almost never do that if we're talking about this is a glass. You have to learn to do magic. You know, it's not like magic at all the time. I thought there was a car there, but when I drove up to it, it disappeared. That doesn't happen.
So why, if we're all seeing the same world, mm-hmm. even if there's some shenanigans involved sometimes and we might interpret it differently, yeah. Why do we seemingly disagree on almost everything? Is that just part of the human condition?
We don't disagree.
We don't?
We don't disagree. I'm just being
oh, there you
funny.
Go. That was good.
Disagreeing by disagreement. Why do we disagree about everything? Well, the further you get, the more reasoning you base from observation, the trickier it gets. Mm-hmm. So we don't disagree, but if I say, are there two glasses with water on the table? We would agree on that. If I say, are there three man-made objects on the table? Yeah. We would agree on that. If I say, is there cause and effect? We might disagree because we have different concepts of cause and effect mm-hmm. means. So as you get more and more abstract, it's more and more subject to error if you misform your concept and subject to miscommunication. So what's the remedy for that? Well, there's no foolproof remedy. When you get to philosophy or even higher science, until there's been a lot of testing and so forth, it's not certain, and you know you can't prove your case. But there comes a point where the evidence from the senses is so overwhelming that you can't deny it. And in science, like, you know, the plate tectonic theory mm-hmm. that we all,
yep.
that took about 100 years for people to say, yeah, that really is right. And the atomic theory, did you know that into the 1920s, there were famous physicists who said, no, electrons don't exist. That's just a made up thing. So at a certain point, the evidence from the senses and the chain of logic from it become overwhelming. But before that, there's a lot of room for argument. And in philosophy, it takes a lot of argument.
So would you say that people that take the leap of faith, is it partly that they're just overwhelmed by the nature of reality?
Yeah, they're overwhelmed, they're over their head. You know, they're trying to give answers to questions they're not ready to answer. That happens a lot. And it happens with objectivists too, which it doesn't come quite in the form of faith, but they can't explain their ideas well. You know, they've just learned some principle like, here's one that happened to me. Man has rights, including property rights. Yeah, I can see that. I believe that. You can't take his stuff. You know, that's his. Okay, suppose a guy owns a plot of land, and you buy up all the land around him and say, you can't cross my land to get out. Mm-hmm. So you've imprisoned him. You know, how do you answer that with absolute property rights? Well, it turns out, there's a right of easement when you buy land. That's already taken care of in the concept. Right. But, you know, I didn't know that. I didn't know what how to answer that question when I heard it at age 20, mm-hmm. you know? So a lot of people who are dealing with questions beyond their pay, beyond where their knowledge is caught up to, act as if they're taking it on faith because they can't connect it back to reality.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of thought. See, Ayn Rand didn't have that problem because no one came and gave her a whole bunch of answers.
Right.
You know, she had to build up slowly. And you can see in her development, at first, she doesn't have the concept of rights and forces the violator of rights. And in the 40s, she gets it. At first, she didn't have a proof of her ethics. And then at a certain point, she figured it out. And she knows exactly when that happened. She was walking back from a cafeteria on Park Avenue back to her apartment, and she got it. She figured out the proof of the, what we now call the proof of the objectivist ethic. So if you're the originator, you're not in any trouble of just accepting answers without knowing what they mean. But people who come in and get all this stuff, it tends to float.
Yeah. You know,
they can't concretize, and that's understandable.
Is that just part of life that certain
yeah.
people?
You have to learn. Yeah. I mean, it's the same in physics. You're taught the equation. I had this problem all the time. I would be taught the equations for, say, a weight going down an inclined plane. And then you get a problem on the quiz. And it's a weight on an inclined plane. And I couldn't solve it. I couldn't figure, which is the equation? And how? What variable stands for what here? So you have to develop fluidity and expertise in any area that's very abstract. I mean, you can be given the formulas and the answers. They don't do you any good until you learn to connect it to reality, perceptual reality.
Yeah. So let's shift a little bit to self-sacrifice. Because
okay.
I think these days, 2019, which is just starting here, it seems that self-sacrifice is really being sold on us all the time. You should do this for others, the whole social justice movement.
Yeah.
This idea that we should be allowed, and now it's coming more and more, that we're going to tax people more and more and more to give to other people, that you should constantly be self-sacrificing for the greater good or for someone else's moral beliefs, something
yeah.
to that effect. You are not a proponent of this idea.
To put it mildly, yeah.
It's evil. How was that? I was easing you in soft.
Yeah, it's evil. It's... We have to first decide what sacrifice is. Sacrifice, as I use the term and as Ayn Rand used, it means the giving up of a higher value for a lower value. It's spending a dollar to get a dime or giving it up altogether, getting nothing for it. So if you buy a stock in the hope of making money and you make money, the investing of that money is not a sacrifice. It's an investment.
Mm-hmm.
But if you give a dollar to charity, it might be a sacrifice, depending upon what you know of that charity. And, you know, I give to some charities that I approve of, but very few, because for one thing, so much is taken from me without my choice by taxes. But a sacrifice is a surrender of a value for a lesser value or a non-value. And why is that wrong? Why is that wrong? Well, because it means moving to death. If you gave up everything, here, take my clothes, take my food, take the breath out of my lungs, you're dead. So your values are your means of sustaining your life. That's what makes them values. They're things that you want to use to survive and live big, right? Mm-hmm. If you give them up, you're taking a loss. You're hurting yourself for what? Well, there have been two answers given. One is you do it for your fellow man. Well, why is he better than me?
Uh-huh.
Why? I can't live for myself, but I can live for Joe. Why is Joe my king?
Well, Joe better be living for you then. Otherwise, this is a bad
exactly.
trade.
Exactly. You yeah. know the phrase, it's more blessed to give than to receive. But if you're giving, somebody has to receive, you know, so here, take this. Oh, no, you take it. No. So the right. way out of that is, you know, they say, well, the one who needs it most should get it. But that means that you're rewarding need, you're rewarding lack. So non-creation of value is what gives you entitlement over the creators of value. And that's really wrong. It's been sold to people because of two confusions. One is they confuse investment with giving up, you know. So people say, well, you have to sacrifice immediate pleasure to get, you know, where you want to go. I had to make a lot of sacrifices to be a success in this industry. No, those were investments. You didn't throw stuff away. You put it to use to get where you are, and you gave up immediate pleasure for more in the future. So that's an investment. And the other is they're told the only alternative is sacrificing others to yourself. So if I'm looking out for number one and only number one, I'm not sacrificing for you. I must be sacrificing you to me. But that's not the alternative. It's not like you got to be a sadist or a masochist. I'm not a masochist, so I'm going to be a sadist. No, you can respect your fellow man and treat him as an equal, like the original American system was set up to do. All men are created equal. Mm-hmm.
Do you find it odd that we're even having this battle in the West? The West, which has been created, and capitalist societies, which have been created on the idea of human ingenuity and go out there and, you know, settle the West and just make whatever you can make and all of these things, and that we seem to be putting that aside?
No, I find it tragic and ironic, perhaps, but I understand the reason. It's because the intellectuals were convinced by that same guy, Immanuel Kant. He wrote that there's a categorical imperative that we all have to do our duty, that morality, I didn't actually get to that One way of self-sacrificing is to sacrifice for your fellow man. The other way is just to hurt yourself for the sake of hurting yourself. And that's what Kant advocated. He said, your action has moral worth only if you have nothing to gain from it. Not that it helps anybody else, that's irrelevant. Mm-hmm. And you might like that other person and be giving something to him because you like. No, the only proof that you're acting from duty is that it hurts you. So he advocated self-flagellation, you know, like the medievals.
Right, so that's really taken root these days where people want to put themselves down in the name of, oh, I'm a social justice warrior or something like that, but it's so strange.
I'm a victim. It's a celebration of victimhood is that, exactly.
Right, which is so strange because it's like if you see a homeless person on the street and you give them money, well, you're allowed to feel good that you gave them money. That would be, you know, I have, and I felt like helping this person. Why can't you feel good about that? The idea that you could only feel bad about that to make it have moral worth actually seems sort of contrary
to
human nature.
It is contrary to human nature, but that doesn't stop them.
No, it certainly does not stop
them. It's like altruism on steroids. It's sacrifice run wild.
So when is it appropriate then to sacrifice?
Never. Never appropriate to take. It's like saying, I'm investing in the market. When is it appropriate to buy high and sell low? Never. You're in it to profit. There's an eternity coming where you won't exist. You'll be dead forever.
Well, would it be appropriate to sacrifice if you saw that somebody was about to shoot a child and you jumped in front of the bullet?
No.
Would it be appropriate to sacrifice?
No. It would be appropriate to risk your life to try and stop him. But just to have you be killed rather than the baby, what is that going to solve? His next shot will be the baby. You know, those kind of examples are not what life is made of. Anyway, the issue is, your mother wants you to marry a nice Jewish girl and settle down nearby where she can keep her tabs on you. You want to go off and become a pianist and live an entirely different life. Do you owe her? My mother used to say, Hara, you weren't put on this earth just to serve yourself. And my reaction was, I wasn't put on this earth and nobody owns me, right? I am just serving myself.
I'm completely thrown by your mom's accent. Where was she from?
Richmond, Virginia.
Yeah, Virginia. All right, yeah. I was going to say, okay.
That's all right.
So how do we organize a society around those ideas when a society is, by nature, a society is collective? But if we're telling everyone to be in it for yourself, in the best sense of that, with rational self-interest, but you still need to organize some sort of collective set of ideas that are going to be able to govern us.
Well, I wouldn't call them collective. They're shared ideas. They're ideas that are agreed to. So you have to get together with like-minded people. That's an act of independence. And agree to establish a government that will protect you from those who are not like-minded people who want to sacrifice you, by force. So the only principle of social organization is no force, no initiated force. If you use force on us, we'll call the police to use force on you. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to, dance with them. You don't have to marry them. You don't have to form partnerships with them. You'll want to, some people, the people you'll like and people you won't like. But you approach them as equals. Jefferson had this great phrase, the mass of mankind was not born saddled, and a favored few born booted, ready to ride them, spurred and booted, ready to ride them. That's the meaning of we're all created equal. Nobody has the right to make another person live for him. And that's the way that you approach human relationships, as I respect you and you respect me and I leave you free and we agree to things that are win-win relationships.
Do you sense a resurgence of some of these ideas?
Well, in the political realm, yeah. In the political realm, the whole libertarian movement, although Ayn Rand abjured it, was due to Ayn Rand. There's even a book about it usually begins with Ayn Rand.
But you think it's sort of a failure, the Libertarian Party, let's say, because it doesn't have a moral backing beyond.
Yeah, it doesn't.
Yeah.
I mean, that may change. I've seen some hopeful signs in the libertarian movement, but there's a bad anarchist element, subjectivist element in there. And you don't like to call yourself a libertarian, really, right? You call yourself a classical
liberal. I'm a classical liberal.
Yeah, that's a better term.
I believe in a light touch of government. I believe in the individual ultimately, beyond anything else. Mm-hmm. But then I believe that there's a light touch of government is sort of the way I would describe it.
Well, we draw a bright line that the touch of government is against those who use force. Criminals, foreign invaders. But it's not just the degree of pressure, it's that you cannot have the government initiate force, start the use of force against someone who hasn't used it on anyone else. The government is there to secure rights, as Jefferson put in the Declaration, to secure these rights governments are established. And that's, what objectivism advocates politically is that original thing, and that is classical liberal and libertarian, they get kind of wacky, but I'm hoping that will improve. But the main thing, the point I was making is that when I started in the 60s advocating for capitalism, capitalism was a four-letter word. You said, I'm for capitalism. People went like that. It was really amazing. And now free markets, capitalism, libertarianism is a thing. The New York Times says conservatives and libertarians think X. Mm-hmm. So it's been created. So that's a good thing if we can get the wackiness out of that.
Right. The New York Times isn't thrilled with those ideas, but at least they write about them.
They
with
write
some
about them.
Context or something of that nature.
And the foreign policy of the libertarians, I don't endorse that at all.
Yeah, we'd have to save that for a whole other.
Yeah.
Thing.
Yeah.
So to bring us home here, if somebody's watching this and they heard you have your wake up moment, is there something that we're going to put a playlist of, uh-huh. of some of the lectures that you've done in the description below. But is there anything else you would point them to?
I have a blog and a membership site called HarryBinswangerLetter.com.
It's HBLetter.com, right?
HB Letter. You know it better than I do.
Yeah.
It's hbletter.com is the URL. Yeah. Harry Binswanger is what it stands for.
Right. You don't have to spell all that. HB Letter.
HBLetter.com. Yeah. And there's a free trial. And that's if you are interested in pursuing these ideas further.
Great. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.